From Lebanon to Hermitage, Indiana to Countersport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the biggest problem facing Pennsylvania employers is the lack of a qualified workforce, and the lack of relevant educational opportunities is contributing to the problem. David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And events of the past 2 weeks have knocked both Republicans and Democrats off message. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, we have news headlines from patownhall.com. Dina Powell McCormick, a former advisor to President Donald Trump and banking executive, has been named the new president of Meta, which is the parent company of Facebook. The wife of Pennsylvania's U.S. Senator David McCormick, she will also serve as vice chairman of the Meta board, reporting directly to founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Mrs. McCormick already serves on the Meta board. She has had a career in the financial industry, having spent 16 years in senior leadership roles at Goldman Sachs. Two Republican congressmen from Pennsylvania have lost the support of the powerful grassroots group Americans for Prosperity. U.S. Representatives Rob Bresnahan and Ryan McKenzie received strong backing from AFP in their winning campaigns 2 years ago. But they joined with Bucks County Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick after siding with House Democrats on a recent vote to extend expiring COVID-era health care subsidies, which primarily benefit insurance companies. The legislation passed the House but appears unlikely to get Senate approval, as the GOP majority in the Senate is considering more consumer-friendly health care reforms. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, passed last summer, includes a provision for a nationwide program designed to give parents and students the ability to finance school choice options. It is a federal tax credit program. It allows individual taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit of up to $1,700 for contributions to scholarship-granting organizations. The catch? Each state must opt into the program. To that end, Republican members of the Pennsylvania House Education Committee have sent a letter to Governor Josh Shapiro asking him to opt into the program. U.S. Senator Dave McCormick likewise has urged the governor to include Pennsylvania in the program. Shapiro has a track record of opposing funding for any program that gives parents school choice options. He only wants to add money to government-funded public schools. U-Haul has released statistics showing that more people are moving out of Pennsylvania than are leaving all but five other states. California, New York, and Illinois have the most residents leaving, while Texas, Florida, Tennessee, and North Carolina are experiencing a net in-migration. Not coincidentally, people are leaving high-tax states and moving to low-tax states. They also have better weather. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Finding and keeping qualified employees is one of, if not the most significant problem facing Pennsylvania businesses. State education and social welfare policies are aggravating the situation. Here to parse through the situation is our Capital Watch crew. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, we have your Capital Watch All-Stars from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, President and CEO Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, thanks for being on the program.
Great to be back again, David. Thank you.
And right alongside her, my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to see you.
My pleasure to be here, David. Thank you.
Well, here we are back here in Sin City, Harrisburg, PA, trying to keep track of what's going on. And actually, Steve, you had some thoughts that you had shared in recent opinion editorials. What's going on?
Sure. I talked about some of the things that lawmakers in Pennsylvania must face in the new year here in 2026. And it's a list that I think it symbolizes some of the crossroads of where Pennsylvania is in terms of who's going to be in charge of our state, who's going to get elected, as we see new elections are going to be coming up later this year and so forth. But here's a core focus on what, anyway, I believe, and one of my colleagues at the Commonwealth Foundation, Megan Martin, believes. We wrote an article together on these subjects. And really, there are a number of areas. I want to start with empowering families with educational choice, making sure that it's parents and not bureaucrats that decide what's best for our children. We have steadily been growing our educational choice programs in Pennsylvania, not just for many years, but for many decades, really starting in the year 2001. And since that time, it's been a long slog. It's been a hard battle. There are deeply entrenched special interests that are against reforming our education system. Yes. And so I'm pleased to report, though, that we've reached the highest peak we've ever reached in terms of students served by school choice alternatives here in Pennsylvania. And notably, we have now more than 101,000 scholarship students in the EITC and OSTC programs.
Wow.
Which puts us second, or third rather, to only two other states, Ohio and Florida. So we are leading the nation. We're literally creating an example of perseverance, again, a 25-year struggle, and starting to get traction by people all over the spectrum who are genuinely concerned about our kids, who are willing to try to help expand school choice in Pennsylvania. And so we're seeing unprecedented success in that arena, but we can't let up. There were over 63,000 EITC and OSTC scholarship applicants who got rejected, not because they had anything wrong with them or that they hadn't excelled in their studies and all those, only because there's an artificial cap on the program. And so one of the things we need to work on in this coming year is reducing that cap so all those kids can get the same benefits that so many are and actually have a shot at a decent education. Another one that we talked about is confronting the deficit. That's also crucial. We've had a built-in structural deficit in recent years, and we saw in the last election cycle there was a real battle over whether we could stop the raid against the emergency fund in Pennsylvania,
right.
the money that's set aside for a rainy day. And fortunately, at the end of that battle, it was not touched, but the difficult structural challenges remain.
Yeah, and just if I could interject here,
sure.
This is, again, a story the listeners have heard me tell, but I want to tell it again because this is one of the central realities of the state budget and the fiscal situation in Harrisburg, that the structural deficit that Steve made mention of means that mandatory spending is increasing at a faster rate than the growth of the economy and the revenues that are collected by the Commonwealth. So we have mandatory spending in the form of service programs for needy folks, many of them seniors, and that Pennsylvania has this problem where we have more and more folks who are beyond their working years, retirees, people who themselves require taxpayer-funded assistance, and not enough younger folks in their working lives to pay the bills to sustain state government at its current scale. So regardless of what anybody wants to spend, wants to do, programs to initiate and stuff, like underlying the fiscal reality of the Commonwealth is this growing structural gap.
And for that gap to continue, the real answer is successful commerce here in our state, manufacturing and all the other types of industries that generate good for Pennsylvanians and at the same time are creating jobs and providing us with quality products that we need. But there's still problems in that sector, too, that are caused artificially for no good reason. Just like those kids are shut out from the school choice programs, there's 164,000 restrictions in Pennsylvania in terms of regulations that are put out to address virtually anything anyone can think of, 164,000. And it's not that we are saying there should be no regulations. No one's saying that. But 164,000 is too much.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's clearly not, it's clearly too much. And it's putting us at a great disadvantage as compared to other states who are doing things more efficiently and effectively. So again, part of the state budget last year was beginning to address this. There was great work done. And there was some advancement of things like deemed approval permitting. but we still face this massive mountain of unnecessary regulation that's slowing everything down.
Yeah, and so, Steve, the thing that makes me crazy is that we have this mountain of rules, and yet nobody has the job of going back and checking, of saying, well, did these rules work the way that they were intended? Were there unintended consequences that need to be addressed? Did the changes actually solve the problem and therefore the rule is no longer necessary? Like, it's like painting the same door over and over without ever scraping off the underlying layers. And so just, again, it's the point that Steve made, that nobody is saying that there shouldn't be rules. We're saying that the rules should make sense, that they should be based on sound science, that they should undergo some kind of meaningful independent cost-benefit analysis, and again, that somebody should go back and check in some kind of organized, systematic way to make sure that these things are still worth the doing.
And then going forward, one of the important things that we're talking about is regulating the regulators themselves,
mm-hmm.
saying that our General Assembly would have the opportunity to vote on major new regulations that were being promulgated by the administration so that that battle could be had and that things would not just get slipped through the cracks. And so that's critical. Right now, the regulatory authorities act almost without restraint.
Mm-hmm.
This bill, the RAINS Act, would actually allow for them to be regulated for once. And they'd see it, take a taste of their own medicine and see what that's like.
Yes, that if one of these executive agencies is going to put forward a rule that the rest of us have to live under and that the economic impact of that rule would be above a certain level, that it would be necessary for the General Assembly to vote to affirmatively approve that rule before it could go into effect. Like, isn't that what representative self-government is supposed to be all about? That makes perfect sense to me. And yes, that those are long overdue reforms.
Well, and the thing too is, like you said, David, not only is there nobody looking and doing an actual cost-benefit analysis as to the rules that are already in effect, there's 164,000 rules that we were just talking about, but it's actually, it works to the disadvantage in more ways than one, because the more regulations there are, the more government there has to be to support those regulations too, and the more expensive it is to do so. So the more regulations there are, the bigger the government has to be. So when you have more and more rules, you have to have more and more folks in the government that need to enforce those rules. So it's a self-perpetuating system that we have when you have an exorbitant number of rules like Pennsylvania does, because you have to have inspectors. You have to have attorneys. You have to have folks to enforce each of those rules too. So not only is it an onus on the businesses that are having to deal with all of these rules and regulations and the permits that they're required and all of that onus on the business itself, but the businesses then are also paying the taxes or the fees that have to support the enormous cost of the government that needs to maintain those rules.
Right. Yes.
So it's actually a double burden.
It's a double loss.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation.
And there were a couple other points I just want to cover quickly, David, in terms of the article that I've been talking about what to look for in Pennsylvania politics or legislative policy in the upcoming year. One of those is the fact that we do have to help try to fix in some manner the social safety net. One of the problems is there has been such a lack of proper oversight that our public welfare programs are extremely expensive. They're consuming a huge part of the Pennsylvania budget every year and only getting bigger. There's been issues with wastes, fraud, and abuse, and all those sorts of things. So one of the key things is that we've got to make sure we're focusing on reforming public welfare in a way that takes care of those who have a true need, but in the meanwhile, doesn't cost the hardworking taxpayer more than necessary to take care of those needs.
Yes.
We can do that, but we've got to do it in a sensible way and not let these costs just get completely out of control.
Yes, and we cannot pay for idleness. There's not enough money in the world to pay for people to not work, people who could otherwise work. And I know that there's a faction of opinion that says, oh, well, that makes you a big meanie to insist on work requirements and such. And I would take the opposite approach and say that actually, if we care about people and that we want people who are able to work, to have the dignity and purposefulness that comes from being engaged with the world, being self-sufficient, providing for their themselves and their families, that it is better for them to be undergoing some kind of training, going to school, or even volunteering for, what is it, the recommendation is 20 hours a week, that the longer that somebody is on the sofa, the more that their skills degrade. And of course, bodies at rest tend to stay at rest. But beyond that, also, when it comes to trying to get the next job, you need to have references. Somebody needs to know you so they can vouch for you. And the longer that you've been out of the workforce, the more dated, the staler those contacts become. And so there'll be nobody left to be able to vouch for you that, oh, yeah, when that guy worked for me a couple years ago, he was an okay guy. It's like, no. Volunteer, do good, whether it's at the Humane Society or the Salvation Army, wherever. At least if you put in the effort, somebody there will be able to say, yes, I know that person, and yes, that person was diligent and did a good job, and yes, I think that person would be a good employee for you. But when we don't require those things and we just let people collect benefits and not work when they could work, not only is it an insult to all of the taxpayers who do go to work every day to provide for themselves and their families, and then on top of that, pay taxes, that it's also, it's an unkindness to the people who really need the benefits, which is where our efforts should be concentrated to deliver the help that's really needed to the people who really need it. But also, like I said, I mean, human beings were never meant to be kept like pets or zoo animals. Human beings have inherent dignity and worth, and that if it requires tough love to get people in motion and for them to reclaim responsibility for their lives, that is a good and necessary thing that we have to do.
Not to mention the fact that obviously getting more folks into the workforce and contributing to the economic vitality of the state is necessary to growing the economy.
Yes, yes, we have a workforce crisis. It's one of the most pressing things in the productive sector. And it's just, it's infuriating that we have these really good family-sustaining jobs on offer, but not enough qualified new hires to fully staff up. And it winds up being a cap on economic growth.
Yes.
Because so our employers are having difficulty fully staffing to maintain current levels of production. There's more work to be had. There are contracts that people could bid on. But if you can't find enough qualified new hires to add another production line or to hire a third shift, like, you can't go after that work because you couldn't do it because you don't have the capacity. And so this disconnect of having working age adults who have no dependents, who are not in any way incapacitated, like, for those folks to not be working, they're shortchanging themselves, they're shortchanging the taxpayer, but as Rebecca correctly notes, they're also shortchanging the whole of society that really is aching for their positive contribution.
I mean, if you look around, the three of us all have the type of jobs where we end up meeting a lot of people very frequently. We're meeting people all day and having conversations with folks and getting to know them a little bit. And so many times the folks I speak to all across the state, not just in near the Capitol or anything like that, it's everywhere. They tell me that the biggest concern they have is that they have some sort of a business and they cannot find the employees that they need to staff their business. And therefore, they are producing much less than they would be. There are projects on hold. There's equipment sitting idle. There's capital that's just sort of frozen there, rusting, because of this terrible, chronic, ongoing need for people who can work these jobs. And they're good jobs, well-paying, great benefits. But that workforce, as you noted, it seems almost as if they've kind of walked away from their part of the social compact.
Well, and actually, Steve, this also goes back to education. Like, we need our public K-12 education system to be rigorous and challenging and meaningful and to prepare people for success in life, including success in the workplace. And too often, we have schools that fail to deliver that for the students who are entrusted to their care. This is why the accountability that comes from competition is so urgently needed. We need the K through 12 school system to work better, to be more effective, to better prepare our young people. And as those of us who are part of the private sector economy realize that competition is the only way to bring about that kind of accountability, in the same way that FedEx and UPS have helped to make the U.S. Postal Service less bad, that this is the goal of having competition, new choices, alternatives for families to choose for their kids, that this would force the incumbent system to respond and to improve itself. And because currently when you have a monopoly that's run by a bureaucracy, that's about the most inefficient way to provide any kind of service.
It's a test of really, do we understand who we are as a culture? Are we a culture that's about just taking care of ourselves in a way that disregards the needs of others and the needs of our communities, and a lifestyle where we're committed to making our little place in Pennsylvania the best part of the world?
Yeah, and for people to improve themselves, that's where it starts. All of this talk about a minimum wage and raising the government mandated wages, it's like, no, people need to work on improving themselves and being able to bring more to the job. And that for our people in government, our decision makers, the lawmakers, the people who oversee our job training and workforce development system, like, we need to train people to take up the kind of jobs that are available in the private sector, in trucking, in manufacturing, that are $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year with good benefits and retirement money. These are the kinds of jobs that go wanting. And boy, people would be a lot better off in a job like that than working for $15 an hour. Oh, well, anyway, we have gone around the horn. We've kicked the can around. Sadly, we're down to the last of our time here for this week's program. But before we go, Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and your group and the things that you do?
They can visit the CommonwealthFoundation.org, CommonwealthFoundation.org.
Outstanding. And Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
They can find us at PMTA.org.
Outstanding. And as always, you can find me online at PAManufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
In recent weeks, events have knocked both Republicans and Democrats off message. The GOP should be focusing on the recent round of statistics that show the U.S. economy is improving, and Democrats win when they focus on the issue of health care. There is no doubt the nation's health care system is in crisis. The so-called Affordable Care Act, best known as Obamacare, has been an abject failure. Its provisions have resulted in skyrocketing health care costs, which have been somewhat mitigated by taxpayer-financed subsidies. One such set of subsidies, passed in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, ended at the close of 2025. While the ending of those subsidies account for a very small percentage of healthcare cost increases, and the benefits accrue mostly to insurance companies, Democrats have successfully made their expiration the villain. A rare fracture in House GOP unity occurred last week when a few apostate Republicans, including three from Pennsylvania, joined with Democrats to pass an extension of those subsidies. That should have been the focus of Democrat messaging, but a tragic event intervened. A protester was shot and killed as she attempted to run down an ICE agent with her car. The left's protest industrial machinery went into high gear, taking to the streets in Minneapolis and in cities across the nation, having found their latest reason to parade in front of the television cameras. In last year's presidential election, opinion polls consistently showed illegal immigration and the economy topped the list of voter concerns. Removing illegal aliens, especially those who have committed crimes, has been a top priority of the Trump administration, which has been highly successful in its efforts. Thus did the left place the spotlight on an issue where their policies are widely unpopular. Worse, the constant taking to the streets in protest over every action of the Trump administration has worn thin. The American public has tuned them out. Events have also knocked Republicans off message. As 2025 drew to a close, President Trump was back on the campaign trail as he and other administration officials focused on the affordability issue and on the economy. This is a key issue set for voters. Then came the successful capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in a daring raid executed by the U.S. military and intelligence agencies. The spotlight swung from the economy to foreign affairs, with the Venezuelan raid, more U.S. posturing over Greenland, and the popular uprising in Iran taking center stage. President Trump's growing list of foreign policy successes is indeed impressive. But at the end of the day, kitchen table issues matter most. The growing cost of health care is the Republicans' Achilles heel. President Trump has messaged effectively that the focus of health care reform should be on patients rather than on insurance companies. But congressional Republicans have yet to come up with a comprehensive, understandable plan. The Democrat plan is simply to throw more taxpayer dollars into healthcare subsidies. That, however, is unsustainable in the mid to long run. But midterm elections are upon us, and that simple solution is sellable. The GOP, by contrast, must develop a plan to fix a complicated, broken system. Doing that is considerably more complicated and difficult to effectively communicate to voters. The GOP, therefore, must return to messaging on the economy. The nation is still experiencing a hangover from the Biden administration's failed policies that have baked over 22% inflation into the family budget. Promising signs of an improving economy are already surfacing. Inflation, while still above the Federal Reserve's 3% annual target rate, has dropped and is not showing signs of resurgence. As of last week, the Federal Reserve is projecting fourth quarter 2025 GDP growth to have been a healthy 5.4%. The biggest jolt to the economy will come as federal taxpayers receive higher than usual refund checks. Federal exemption of taxes on tips, overtime, and Social Security will manifest in higher refunds. What would have been a large increase in taxes was avoided when the One Big Beautiful Bill Act permanently extended the 2017 middle-class tax cuts. Businesses will benefit from 100% expensing and removal of federal regulations and their associated compliance costs. Many businesses are responding to tariffs by moving manufacturing and other operations into the United States. This takes time, and those impacts will begin to be felt as 2026 progresses. Republicans are well positioned to benefit from all of these trends. They also benefit by having identifiable leadership, while Democrats are floundering, caught in the cross currents of failed traditional policies and ascendant radical socialism. Foreign policy successes are important, but if the GOP wants to retain its majorities in Congress, the focus must be on the economy. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WRSC-FM in Bellefonte, WKFO-AM in Katanning, along with WMBS-AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.